This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
In a world overflowing with noise, shallow takes, and information that evaporates the moment you hear it, Selenius Media exists for one purpose: to give you depth. Whether the subject is philosophy, psychology, history, science, artificial intelligence, literature, or the shape of the future, every series we publish is built on one idea: that thinking clearly is a form of survival. Our catalog spans dozens of long-form, story-driven shows. From Western moral philosophy for beginners to pioneers of psychology and psychiatry, from AI and uncertain future to the classical music giants, each series is crafted to give you more than facts. It gives you the context, the conflict, and the human meaning behind the ideas that shaped our world. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces. Intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. Visit the Selenius Media channel to discover new series, follow your favorites, and support the work that allows us to create long-form, high-fidelity educational storytelling. And please leave comments if you enjoy our shows. Now, let's begin. In the late 10th century, in a village near Bukhara on the edge of the Persian world, a boy sits at a low table, copying lines of Arabic in a quick, steady hand. Outside, caravans creak along the Silk Road, carrying silk, spices, paper, and stories between China, Central Asia, and the cities of the Islamic world. Inside, this boy's father is entertaining visitors from a new esoteric movement, the Ismailis, talking about the hidden meanings of scripture and the structure of the cosmos. The boy listens, half fascinated, half critical. He is already reading far beyond his years. And he is already developing a private habit. When adults make big claims about God or the world, he wants to see the argument. The boy's name is Hussein ibn Abdullah, but posterity will know him as Avicenna, the Latinized form that will travel into medieval Europe and become a pillar of Western metaphysics and moral thought. He will be remembered as a physician, a logician, a scientist, a mystic, and above all as a philosopher who tried to pull together Greek, Islamic, and personal experience into a single, coherent vision of reality and the good life. He was born around 980, probably in Afshana near Bukhara in the region of Khorasan, under the Samanid dynasty. This was a moment when the Islamic world was intellectually alive in a way difficult to overstate. Greek philosophy and science had been translated into Arabic for over a century. Plato, Aristotle, Galen, Euclid, Ptolemy. Commentaries, critiques, and syntheses had proliferated. The Quran and prophetic traditions were being interpreted through lenses borrowed from late antique philosophy. To be an ambitious mind in that era was to breathe a mix of revelation and reason, theology and metaphysics. Avicenna's father, a local official, made sure his son had the best education available. By his teens, the boy had mastered the Quran, Arabic literature, basic jurisprudence, and the standard sciences. Then he moved into more demanding territory: logic, geometry, astronomy, medicine. Every time he hit a wall, he pushed. He later tells the story of reading Aristotle's Metaphysics 40 times, to the point of memorizing it, without understanding it, until, by chance, he bought a brief commentary by Al-Farabi in a bookstall. Suddenly, he says, the whole thing became clear. He went home and gave alms in gratitude. The story, whether embellished or not, captures something essential. For Avicenna, philosophy is not just a game, but a discipline of understanding that demands repetition, frustration, and sudden breakthrough. His confidence in his own powers grew early. By 16, he was practicing medicine. By 18, he was treating the Samanid ruler himself. When the ruler recovered from an illness under his care, Avicenna gained access to the royal library, one of the finest collections of books in the region. There he devoured works in every discipline, building the foundation for the encyclopedic knowledge that would later stun Europe. But the library, and the Samanids, did not last. Political upheaval swept the region. Dynasties rose and fell. Warlords traded control of cities. Libraries burned. Avicenna's life became a series of moves from court to court, sometimes honored as a physician and scholar, sometimes imprisoned when political factions shifted. He wrote wherever he was, dictating to students, composing at night, revising on the move. The works he produced in this unstable life, especially the monumental Book of Healing, a vast philosophical encyclopedia, and the Canon of Medicine, would become standard reference points from Spain to Central Asia. For your purposes, what matters is not his medical recipes, but the moral architecture that sits inside his metaphysics. Avicenna inherits from Aristotle and the Neoplatonists a layered picture of reality, God as the first principle, a cascade of intellects and spheres, a rationally ordered cosmos. But he reworks it with a distinctive emphasis on existence, necessity, and the human soul's journey toward perfection. At the center of his metaphysics is the distinction between what something is, its essence, and the mere fact that it is, its existence. You can understand hoarseness as an essence, as a concept, without committing yourself to any particular horse being real. In your mind, triangles, phoenixes, and unicorns all have definitions. What they do not all have is existence. Existence, Avicenna argues, is something added to an essence, something received. There are many possible essences, only some are actually instantiated. The question, why this rather than nothing, now becomes the question, why do these essences have existence? He answers with the notion of the necessary existent. Most things, he says, are possible in themselves. They might exist or not. Nothing about their essence guarantees existence. If they do exist, their existence must come from something else. But this can't go on in an infinite regress of dependent beings. There must be at least one being that is necessary in itself, whose essence is existence, which cannot not be, which does not receive existence from anything else but gives it. This necessary existent is what the religious traditions call God. The necessary existent is absolutely simple. It has no parts, no composition, no potentiality waiting to be realized. It is pure actuality. From it, by a kind of intellectual emanation, flows the rest of reality. Avicenna imagines a series of intellects and celestial spheres, each level receiving existence and intelligibility from above and transmitting it downward. The details of this cosmology are less important now than the moral shape it gives to the world. The universe is not chaotic or morally indifferent. It is a rational order grounded in a perfect source. The closer a being is to that source in its form of existence and its way of knowing, the more perfect and good it is. Human souls occupy an interesting middle position. On the one hand, we are tied to matter. Our bodies change, decay, suffer. On the other hand, we have an immaterial intellect capable of grasping universal forms. When you understand justice, or triangle, or humanity, you are not just running images in your head. You are participating, Avicenna thinks, in an intellectual order that transcends any particular image. The human rational soul is therefore not a mere harmony of bodily elements. It is a distinct, immaterial substance, brought into being by God and capable of subsisting after bodily death. He illustrates this in a thought experiment that would echo in later philosophy, the flying man. Imagine, he says, a person created all at once, fully formed, suspended in the air, with no sensory contact with anything, eyes covered, no sounds, no touch, no bodily awareness. Would this person be aware of anything? Avicenna argues that such a flying man would still be aware of his own existence. He would know I am, even though he would not know anything about his body. This suggests, he says, that the soul is immediately present to itself, and that self-awareness does not depend entirely on bodily sensation. The self is not identical to the body. Why does this matter morally? Because for Avicenna, the good life for a being depends on its nature. A horse's perfection is to be a good horse, strong, agile, responsive. A human being's perfection, beyond basic health and social functioning, is intellectual and spiritual. We are at our best when our rational soul is fully actualized. When it has moved from mere potential understanding to a stable, luminous grasp of truth, especially of the necessary existent. Our deepest happiness, then, cannot lie in sensory pleasures or social status alone. It lies in a contemplative knowledge of God and of the order of reality. That does not mean withdrawing from the world into pure abstraction. Avicenna is a physician. He knows bodies matter. He values the practical sciences, ethics, politics, economics, but he ranks them. The practices that sustain bodily life and social order are lower. The contemplative life is higher. The task of moral philosophy is to guide the soul through this hierarchy, to teach it how to regulate its passions, perform just actions, participate in a rightly ordered community, and ultimately ascend to a more unified, intellectual love of God. He takes over from Aristotle the idea that the soul has faculties, the vegetative for growth and nutrition, the animal for perception and movement, and the rational for thinking and willing. Within the human soul, these faculties can conflict. The appetitive part pulls toward pleasure and away from pain. The irascible part flares in anger and ambition. The rational part sees long-term goods and higher ends. Ethics, in this framework, is about training the lower faculties to obey reason. Virtues are stable dispositions that align appetite and anger with what is truly good. For example, courage is not just rushing into danger. It is the cultivated ability to face fear in defense of a rationally recognized good. Temperance is not mere abstinence. It is the measured enjoyment of bodily pleasures in ways that do not derail the soul's progress. Justice, in the individual, is the harmonious ordering of the soul's powers, each part performing its appropriate function under the guidance of reason. Justice in society mirrors this. Each class and institution fulfilling its role within a larger whole oriented toward the common good. Here, though, Avicenna introduces a specifically Islamic and prophetic dimension that will be crucial for Western moral philosophy's development. Human reason, he thinks, can discover much about virtue and the structure of reality, but not everyone has the leisure, training, or native capacity to follow long philosophical arguments. Societies need law, ritual, stories, and concrete guidance. They need a way to translate metaphysical truths and ethical ideals into images and practices accessible to ordinary people. This is the role of prophecy. The prophet in Avicenna's anthropology is not a passive mouthpiece, mechanically reciting words dropped in from outside. The prophet is a human being whose rational and imaginative faculties are extraordinarily perfected. Through a special relation to the active intellect, the last of the cosmic intellects emanating from God, the prophet receives universal truths in a direct, intuitive way. His powerful imagination then clothes those truths in symbolic language, laws, and rituals that can shape a whole community's life. Scripture and religious law are, in this sense, a pedagogical adaptation of philosophical wisdom to the needs of the many. This gives moral law a double nature. On the one hand, it is grounded in objective truths about human nature and God. It is not arbitrary. On the other hand, it is expressed in a particular historical and cultural form, with specific commands and stories. Avicenna thus sits between rationalism and traditionalism. He will argue that some moral norms can be known by reason alone, kindness, justice, honesty. But he also sees revelation as necessary to give those...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Norms, institutional form, and emotional force. And to direct them toward humanity's ultimate good, which is union with God through knowledge. In his own life, Avicenna is not a cloistered ascetic. He serves at courts, drinks wine, has friendships and conflicts, flees enemies, negotiates politics. This makes his ethical writings less idealized than some. He knows that philosophers do not float above power. They need patrons, and patrons always come with rivalries, flattery, and risk. He speaks of the goods of this world as real but secondary. Wealth, health, rank. These are, at best, instruments for higher ends. They can be used well or badly. To cling to them as final is a grave mistake. You can feel in his work the pressure of mortality and contingency. He writes a whole canon of medicine, thinking about how to preserve health and treat disease, yet he himself dies in his 50s, worn out by illness and overwork, administering his own remedies in a desperate bid to keep functioning. He is buried in Hamadan. Whatever perfection of soul he thought possible through philosophy had to be achieved under the conditions of a fragile body in a fragile political order. This tension between an intellectually serene picture of the soul's ascent and the messy realities of life is part of what makes his moral philosophy compelling rather than abstract. From the perspective of Western moral thought, Avicenna's impact comes in part through direct transmission. His works are translated into Latin in the 12th and 13th centuries. European scholars encounter him as Avicenna, a master of medicine and metaphysics. When Aquinas, Bonaventure, and other scholastics debate the nature of God, the soul, intellect, and the virtues, they are often arguing with, against, or through Avicennian positions. The very language of necessary being, of the distinction between essence and existence, enters Western vocabularies partly through him. Ethically, his insistence that happiness is not just a matter of external goods, but of intellectual and spiritual perfection, reinforces a long Platonic and Aristotelian tradition, now embedded in a monotheistic framework. The ultimate end of human life, he says, is felicity in the hereafter, the soul's continued existence in closer proximity to the divine. That felicity depends not on ritual compliance alone, but on the soul's having become what it can be, a clear mirror of intelligible reality. This pushes Christian thinkers to refine their own accounts of the beatific vision, of virtue and grace, of the relationship between natural and supernatural happiness. At the same time, Avicenna offers Western moral philosophy the model of how to integrate scientific rationality with a theistic worldview. He does not oppose empirical investigation to piety. To study the human body, the structure of the heavens. The principles of motion is for him a way of tracing the intelligible order that flows from the necessary existent. Ignorance is not a virtue, it is a defect. Moral life includes, for those able, a responsibility to understand the world truly. This ideal, the philosopher-physician who heals both body and soul, will haunt Western imagination long after his specific doctrines fade. You can also see in Avicenna a pattern of tension that will recur in later moral debates, the pull between universal reason and particular revelation. On one side, the intellect sees ethical truths that seem available to anyone who thinks carefully. On the other, a historical community receives a specific law and narrative that claim divine origin. When they align, you have a sense of cosmic harmony. God commands what reason already sees is good. When they appear to diverge, conflicts arise. Do we reinterpret the text, limit its application, or distrust our moral reasoning? Avicenna himself does not dramatize this conflict. He assumes, largely, that the law of his community and the deliverances of his metaphysics can be harmonized. But he quietly gives later thinkers tools that can be used to critique fanaticism. If the ultimate end of law is the perfection of the rational soul in knowledge of God, then interpretations of law that brutalize intellect, crush inquiry, or turn God into a capricious tyrant are suspect. They fail to match the necessary existent who is pure goodness and intelligibility. That line of thought will be developed explicitly by later philosophers, both in the Islamic world and in Latin Christendom. For your series, placing Avicenna after Augustine and before later medieval and modern thinkers highlights a continuity that is often missed. Western moral philosophy is not just a straight line from Athens to Rome to Paris. It passes through Baghdad, Bukhara, and Cordoba. Questions about the good life, virtue, law, and happiness are being worked out in Arabic centuries before they resurface in Latin. When Aquinas asks how natural law, divine law, and human law relate, there are Avicennian and other Islamic voices in the mix behind the scenes. Imagine Avicenna one night in a dimly lit room, somewhere between courts, his manuscripts piled around him. A student reads aloud a passage from Aristotle. Avicenna stops him, corrects the logic, sketches a diagram, dictates a paragraph. Outside, the political situation may be unstable. A patron may be on the verge of falling. A rival faction may be plotting. Inside, he is building a world in thought. A God who is necessary being, a hierarchy of intellects, a rational soul, capable of knowing itself and its source. a set of virtues that polish that soul into clarity. He is not naive about human frailty. He knows people act from passion, habit, and ignorance. He prescribes disciplines, ethical and medical, that can mitigate some of this. But he believes that there is a structure to the universe and to the human person that makes moral progress possible. The necessary existent does not abandon the world it sustains in being. It is present as the very act of existence of everything. The active intellect is always available as a source of illumination. The human soul, however entangled in appetites and fears, retains a capacity to turn toward truth. In that sense, his moral philosophy is both rigorous and quietly hopeful. He does not promise easy comfort. He does not say that wealth or health or social praise guarantee happiness. He does not treat law as a magic shield against vice. He insists, instead, that the good life is a long work of aligning ourselves with what is most real, disciplining desire, practicing justice, seeking knowledge, opening the mind to the source of all being. In a world that often feels as unstable as his did, politically fractured, intellectually noisy, that image of the philosopher-physician at his desk, writing calmly about the soul's perfection while empires shift outside, has a certain resonance.
white rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and left me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories, I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Sunrise paints the horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be.